Please silence all electronic devices.
I'm sorry, folks. I don't trust them, and our folks don't trust them.
There is a great deal of overreaction from those who are criticizing this legislation. They will see me in court. You know, if the General Assembly were really trying to do a power grab, there's a lot of things the General Assembly could do, and we weren't.
And they don't have a very good track record there.
Any further discussion or debate?
From the press bunker at the North Carolina Legislature, this is the WNC Politics Podcast. It's the final day of July 2019, week numero 5 of a budget impasse. On this edition of the program, we're chatting with the Speaker of the North Carolina House, Tim Moore. Mr. Speaker, welcome back to the WNC Politics Podcast.
Good to be with you, Jeff.
Last couple of podcasts we've had on the governor and Senate leader Phil Berger. We began with each of them an update, just opening the door to see if there's any kind of update of significance as it pertains to this budget, ongoing budget conversation. I don't think there is, but we're going to start there. Any sort of update that you can pass along right now?
You know, we passed a great bipartisan budget that I believe really funds the critical needs of our state. And where we are, of course, now is the governor vetoed the budget. We're now a little over 30 days since the veto. And we have tried to work with the governor to come up with a budget. But the problem is the governor is basically demanding Medicaid for all. And that is a demand that simply is not something that we are prepared to agree to. But even if one has that opinion about it, I don't think it's proper to hold the entire budget up, $24 billion budget up, over any one issue. So where are we now? I'm traveling around the state. I'll be traveling this week and next week, going to different areas to meet with the legislative delegation there, but also with local elected officials and other folks to really talk about the good things that our budget does and what's being jeopardized by Governor Cooper's veto at this time. And you know, and I've made it clear, once I feel like we have the votes, and I will tell you that we are very close, once I feel like we have the votes, we're going to take a vote and override the veto.
Real close, over under 2.5.
Well, I haven't given numbers yet, so I'm not going to start now, but we're really close.
But you got to start at some point.
Well, you know, we need 7's the magic number, and we're almost there.
Last direct communication with the governor, next direct communication with the governor.
Last communication probably would have been last week. I'm not sure. You know, it's we really need for the governor to indicate to us that he is going to withdraw the demands of this Medicaid for all. It makes it really difficult to negotiate when that happens. I mean, think about it. It's $24 billion. There's a lot of things you can do to move money around to take care of various policy initiatives. But the proposal that the governor's talked about doing on Medicaid expansion could cost this state up to $6 billion. That's a little more than a rounding number when you're talking about a $24 billion budget, right? That's another $6 billion, $30 billion, you know, with no work requirements, all these issues. There's changes going on at the federal government that may make it even unworkable in many ways. And so what I'm hearing from folks is that they want to see our budget enacted. You know, could we make changes to the budget? Absolutely. I'm not going to go through and, you know, mention we could change X, Y, and Z because I don't want to, you know, as they say, bid against myself. But you know, we everybody would be foolish to think that we passed a $24 billion budget with no room to move on revenue or spending priorities there. So there are things that can be done, but what we've asked the governor to do is say, look, put the Medicaid issue to the side, come talk to us about the budget, and we think we can get something done. And right now, the governor seems to be really stuck on this Medicaid for all expansion.
There is, and I want you to reclassify it if you don't like how I describe it. Carolina Cares is the name of the bill that's in the North mm-hmm. Carolina House. For people that follow North Carolina politics closely, it's been called Medicaid Lite, Diet Medicaid. I mean, it's not the kind of Medicaid expansion that the governor and some of the proponents are asking for, but it is very much an expansion of Medicaid. By my money, the Democrats, by and large, would support that if it went through the North Carolina House. A good number of the members of your caucus would support that. Based on your conversations with the governor and your understanding of where he is, if Carolina Cares were to move forward, and I'm not talking about if it comes first or second, but if Carolina Cares, just in a vacuum, were to move forward and end up on his desk, is that good enough for him to advance the budget?
I don't know. He has indicated in the past that he liked that, but then some of the comments that he has made and some of the comments from some of the Democratic members of the caucus, not all, but a handful, really those who are really on the far left, I would say, respectfully, have indicated that they don't think it does enough because they don't like the work requirements, mm-hmm. for example. And I think that is a key, that's a key issue, because I recognize right now, all around the state, there are people who are struggling to make ends meet. There are people working two and three jobs. You know, if you're making $25,000 a year, but you're somehow being expected to pay $1,500 a month for health insurance, those numbers just don't add up. I mean, that's $18,000. And that's, I mean, because of what's happened with the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare as it's called, ever since, I mean, health insurance was a mess before. But after Obamacare was passed, you know, I like the portability, I like the pre-existing conditions things, but the mandate and all these things, Jeff, what that's now led to is making health insurance unaffordable for so many people. So the expansion that I'm interested in is to try to help those who are already working. They're playing by the rules, they're paying their taxes, they're doing everything they can, but because of what Washington did through Obamacare, they can't make ends meet. I want to try to help take care of those folks. Now, if you compare that to what the governor and those on the far left or the liberals on this issue, they are proposing a Medicaid for all approach. I mean, it's almost like AOC came down from Washington and took over the governor's mansion or something. This hard left agenda of trying to push this stuff with no work requirement, so that someone who is able-bodied, of prime working age, with no kind of impediment, no minor children or anything they're having to take care of, no disability, no limitations to their ability to work, that they want them to get a free health care even if they're not trying. And I don't think that's right. And I don't believe that most North Carolinians think that's a good idea.
Carolina Cares, if it were to move forward today, and it's not, just to be clear, unless you're mm-hmm. about to break some news here, but it's not going to be.
Well, let me be clear. So Carolina Cares will move once we adopt the override on the budget. And I've been very transparent about that. And that's why when the budget rolls over to one day, Carolina Cares follows it.
Not holding his water, but from the governor's perspective and from some on the left, they say that's not good enough. They don't entrust that it will move through the Senate. So that's the juxtaposition of it. But my question is this: how many votes would Carolina Cares achieve in your chamber?
You know, I haven't done a vote count on it, but I do believe it's a majority. I do believe a majority support it. I am told that there are some on the more liberal members of the Democratic caucus who will not vote for it because they don't think it does enough. And then, of course, there are a number in my caucus that won't support it because they don't want to see any type of expansion for a number of valid reasons. And so I think you would see a coalition of members of both sides that would pass the bill in a majority way.
Stepping back a little bit, do you think that this budget impasse, standoff, call it what you will, would be a little bit easier or more realistically worked through in a timely manner if there were more true moderates in the North Carolina legislature?
Well, I believe that this budget, while it's, you could say it's a conservative budget because it does continue fiscal restraint, it does continue with tax relief, it is in by no means what I would consider an extremist budget one way or the other. It is really, I think, a very common sense, pragmatic budget, okay? The problem is that the governor has taken a position so far to the left and so liberal that it has made it difficult to come up with something. You know, I've been the speaker now for three terms. I've been in the House since 2002. I've served in the minority when the Democrats were in charge. And I've served in the majority. By the way, I like the majority a lot better, in case anybody's wondering.
Shocking, yeah.
But I will tell you this. This has been the change that I've seen, and I've had this conversation with a lot of folks. The Democratic members, not all, but most of the Democratic members now, and frankly, and I'm going to put the governor in there, are so far to the left of where the Democrats were in years past, even if I'd say Governor Easley, Governor Perdue, and when Democrats controlled the House last and when they controlled the Senate, where the Democratic Party has gone, not only in North Carolina, but nationally, has gone so far to the left, it's leaving a lot of people who are in the middle or who were moderates leaning left kind of wondering where they go. How do I know that? Well, number one, I watch the news like everybody else, and I see what's going on at the national stage. But in North Carolina, I hear from these folks. I hear from folks who have traditionally supported Democratic candidates, whether it's legislative, governor's race, et cetera, who now are saying, how can I help you guys? And so it's been unexpected support and comment and contact from folks all around the state who believe that the budget that we have proposed as a General Assembly is a very responsible budget, and they're very disappointed in the direction and the position that the governor has taken so far to the left.
He is in his ninth term from Cleveland County, first elected to the North Carolina House in 2002. Speaker Tim Moore here on the WNC Politics Podcast. You can follow him on Twitter at NC House Speaker. Other than this budget, what's left for you all to do?
So, of course, we have the bill that the conference report regarding the ICE detainers and the sheriffs. We're going to take that up at some point. We have some bills that are focusing on a number of issues, whether it's education at K-12 or university education. We have some bills on the calendar that we're dealing with this week, as a matter of fact.
Let me jump in real quick on the ICE measure, and this is a measure trying to get local sheriffs to comply with federal immigration authorities. I mean, I'm really paring it down. I mean, that's the oversimplified version. But it has not been voted on the House, and you all have had it for a couple months now, at least a month.
Right? A few weeks.
Okay.
That's correct.
Are you have the votes for it to get through, but not necessarily the votes for an override? Is that part of the strategy here?
We don't know if we have the votes for an override of a veto, and we don't know if the governor, frankly, would actually veto this bill in mm-hmm. the end. One reason that we slowed it down was to kind of calm down with all the rhetoric that's been out there, because there's a lot of other issues. There's a lot of other rhetoric being drawn into this bill that, frankly, doesn't have a place. This bill is about law enforcement. It's about dealing with a situation where a handful of sheriffs in the state have just decided that they're going to stop working with Immigration and Customs Enforcement. That is a true public safety issue, where if someone has broken the law, and you got to remember this, I mean, it gets twisted around. The facts are, this deals with folks who have broken the law to such an extent that they were actually arrested and taken into custody. So this isn't people out getting speeding tickets or just minor little things. This is like serious offenses. And when these folks are taken into custody, the ICE will issue what's called a detainer, saying, hey, this person's also in the country here illegally. Please maintain this person in your custody, Sheriff, so that we can take them into federal custody because they violated immigration law. And for some reason, no one has explained to me why these sheriffs did it. They haven't given a good reason. They think they ought to be able just to turn these folks loose on the street. Well, what's happening is some of these folks are then going right back out and committing more crimes. We've had several instances of violent assaults occurring after folks have been released. And this is about public safety. Frankly, we shouldn't even be having to do this. But you have some sheriffs out there who are, not many, but enough. They're in some large counties in our state.
And some who ran on the notion that they were not going to comply with ICE officials.
Yeah.
Just to put that context on the table.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah. Maybe so. But, you know, the public safety issue is there. When someone breaks the law in Charlotte, there's nothing stopping them from coming over to Cleveland County and breaking the law there. Look, if we have a violent person in custody, someone who's broken the law, committed crime, why not follow the law and actually make sure that they get turned over to the proper authorities instead of just turning folks loose back out on the street?
So the ICE proposal at this point is not law. Medicaid expansion is not moved anywhere. Those are two of the, from my perspective, more meatier things, more significant mm-hmm. things that have not moved this long session. From your perspective, let's just set those two aside. What's the most notable thing that has not advanced, that you've not sent to the governor, that you would have liked to?
You know, we're still moving some bills. There are a number of bills that are everything from criminal justice issues to economic development to improving the way we do some transportation funds. There are numerous issues out there that we have bills on that are going to get worked out and be fine. But I think the biggest issue right now, and my biggest priority and focus, has been on the state budget, because there's a lot of great stuff in there. I'll give you an example. We talked about for a while about, remember, the rape kits being tested, right? All those old, about that backlog of evidence. Well, this budget takes care of this. We've talked about, for example, pre-K, how important pre-K funding is for our students. We have funding for that. We've talked about significant capital needs across our university system. This budget has funding for a brand new Brody School of Medicine at ECU. It has funding for new facilities at UNC Pembroke, at Fayetteville State, at North Carolina A&T, at North Carolina State, you name it. It's got investment there that's critical to the growth of our state in terms of economic development and education. Other issues we're dealing with, healthcare. You know, here's really what's unfortunate about the whole Medicaid expansion discussion. Two things are getting left out that are really critical when it comes to healthcare. Number one is what services are being provided to that population that's already there. We've expanded services there, for example, for kids with autism, to make sure they get the full range of treatment that they need. We do that in the budget. Well, that was vetoed. All those things I mentioned about university funding and all, those were all vetoed. Helping out hospitals, rural health care. You know, we're sitting here in Raleigh as we're talking today. You got access to health care here. But what if you're out in Hyde County and you have a heart attack? You know, the last thing you're probably worried about is who's going to pay for it. It's going to be, can I get to the doctor in time before I die? Well, there's issues in some of our rural areas where, you know, hospitals are closing. There's limitations on physicians coming to those areas in practice. Talking about that. So we've got legislation working its way through the House now to deal with providing a fund there to help these rural struggling hospitals. So there's a lot of issues out there. And I can't speak for why the governor has chosen one issue to allow it to define everything else, because there's so many other important issues that are there, even in the healthcare sector. So those are a few of the things that, sure. But there's even many more than that.
I want to move on. I want to be mindful of your time, and I want to chat about 2020. But one more question on Medicaid, Carolina Cares. Would you support that bill?
I do. I like Carolina Cares. We're still working through some details. Frankly, there are parts of it that I really like, and there are other parts that I'm not as wild about. But, you know, I recognize that the art of compromise is often used as a bad word, but that's the nature of governing in divided government right now. I mean, we have a governor who's a Democrat, we have a legislature that's Republican, but we're not in a supermajority. So we need to be able to compromise, and we need to be able to, it needs to be a conversation among grown-ups, so to speak, of all working together and trying to be honest, lay the cards on the table and see where we can agree and we can disagree. And I guess that's what's been so disappointing about the negotiations with our governor, is that it's one issue, which is probably one of the most divisive and hotly debated issues in the country right now.
Which is what, Medicaid?
Is Medicaid expansion. This is being talked about all over the country. Is being used as a wedge, or being used as a barrier, frankly, to getting a budget done. I mean, just look at the national debate. You've got, at the national level, you have some on the left wanting Medicare for all.
Right, but Medicare and Medicaid are two. Well, different things.
But it's the same basic concept. You're expanding the size of folks who qualify for it. You're therefore expanding the scope of the coverage. You're increasing the debt and the cost. I mean, it's the same basic debate.
But Medicare is for everyone 65 and older. Medicaid is for people who are living in poverty, people with disabilities. I mean, it's a different.
That's what it's supposed to be. But if you look at what the governor's proposing, he's wanting to make it easier so that just about anybody could qualify for Medicaid. So it's the same debate, Medicare for all or Medicaid for all.
2020, I want to get in a couple of questions before we send you on your way. We learned a couple of weeks ago that Holly Grange is going to run against Dan Forrest in the gubernatorial primary on the Republican side. Is that a good thing for your party?
You know, I have stayed out of the primary. I have the highest respect for Lieutenant Governor Forrest as well as for Representative Grange. I'm friends with both of them, and I have chosen not to endorse anyone. I'm focused squarely on maintaining or taking back our supermajority in the State House.
So I hear that as it is less than ideal to have two Republicans duking it out to then take on Governor Cooper, who you certainly would like to see unseated 15 months from now. Is that a fair classification?
I just want to, you know, look, everybody has the right to run for office, and, you know, whether I have a primary or anyone else, Do I, as someone who is looking at the amount of resources that is being spent in elections, wish that there would be less spent on primaries so that there's more money available for general elections? Yes, I always want that. But that is, it is anyone's right to run for office. And as a result, I just, you know, I stay out of it. Like I say, Lieutenant Governor Forrest is the president of the Senate. And then, of course, Representative Grange is a member of the House and a member of my caucus. And so I just, I've chosen just to stay out of that race. And whichever one of them is the winner of the primary will have my full support in the fall.
In the race for the Democratic nomination for the White House, there are still 20 Democrats in that race. 10 of them were on the debate stage last night, 10 of them tonight. From the standpoint of losing North Carolina and or losing the presidency, from your perspective as a Republican, which Democrat concerns you the most?
With the messaging that I'm seeing from the Democratic candidates for president, none of them concern me for losing North Carolina.
Because, not even Biden?
Not even Biden, because he's had to take positions that are so far to the left of where he has historically been. And what's sad is he's way left of North Carolina, but he looks moderate and sensible compared with a lot of the other Democrats who are running. I mean, this is the most far left field of candidates for any office that I can ever think of in the United States. And I like to think I'm a good student of political history, at least in my lifetime. And I haven't seen anything quite like this. I mean, if you look at where, I don't want to give any, you know, helpful hints to the other side, but if you look at where Democrats tend to be successful, it's where they try to portray themselves as moderates, and they try to paint Republicans as right-wing conservative extremists. If you look at historically where they elect the elections they've won, that's where they have been successful in doing so. But given the primary that the Democrats are running for president, and I think in all candor that where our governor has put himself on Medicaid and on other issues, like on the voter ID, for example, I think these folks are working so hard to appease their base that they are really they're losing ground when it comes to those who are the middle of the road. I mean, I think everybody says it's 40% are going to vote Republican, 40% are going to vote Democratic in the battles for that 20 that 20% in the middle. And I think that my opinion is that where they are putting themselves out there on issues, whether it's free health care for folks who are here illegally or whatever else, they're going so far to the left of where of the mainstream that those middle of the road voters are flocking to the GOP.
The latest poll came out today, Wednesday afternoon, and you've got several notable figures. I mean, the governor of Montana polling at 1%, the senator, a senator from Minnesota, Amy Klobuchar, at 0.4%. I look at some of these numbers. I mean, they're minuscule. Clearly, barring something very strange, these people are not going to get the nomination. From a political standpoint, and I realize you're not advising them, you're not a strategist on the Democratic side, but what are they angling for? Are they angling to turn around and run for a U.S. Senate seat? Are they trying to promote themselves? Is this a – well, like, what do you expect out of these folks three months down the road?
They may just be trying to find a way to get on your podcast. I don't know. But you know, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that one. It's I tell you, that's a – that would be a tough life to live right now, traveling around the country and raising money and putting aside everything to be running for president and coming up with 0.4%. So I don't know. Maybe you can get them down here on the the show and ask them. So
as we sit here today, a day before August 2019, is your plan to run for re-election?
Yes, I will be running for re-election in 2020, and I would anticipate serving as speaker again.
Anything that would throw a wrench in that wheel?
Not that I can think of. So we're already out working hard. We're raising money, traveling the state, doing that. As I mentioned earlier, getting a lot of support from registered Democrats, because I think they realize that the vision that I bring as a speaker and that we bring as a House is trying to be conservative yet very pragmatic to getting things done, getting a good budget, running the state like a business as much as we can, and keeping up where we are. Because look at where we are as a state. I mean, in the context of all the political discourse back and forth, let's don't lose sight of the fact that North Carolina right now has some of the lowest unemployment it's had in decades. More people are working in this state than any time in our state's history. Taxes are the lowest they've been in decades. High school graduation rates are the highest they've been in really ever. Things are going well. We've got, you know, we've got great government programs to help business grow and to work with them. But what we've done even more importantly is that we've worked to create an environment where it's reducing regulation, reducing unnecessary over government, and in reducing taxes and streamlining our tax code to where businesses want to come to North Carolina, where people want to move here. The one challenge, though, as I look around the state, is trying to allow that prosperity to spread to all parts of the state, because urban North Carolina, suburban North Carolina, running really strong. But you know, you get out there in some of our rural areas that are a little further away, got some challenges. So we've got some great success stories we can point to of where things are happening in rural areas, but we really want to make sure that we continue to invest there. So if you didn't ask the question, sure, but I kind of got myself to this point where if I have to say, where do I think the greater challenges from a policy standpoint, the thing that I'm not fully satisfied that we've done yet, that is making sure that rural North Carolina is enjoying the prosperity that we're seeing in the more urban and suburban areas.
Three rapid ones to get you out of here on. Associated Press reporter Gary Robertson, who I share a wall with, said to me years ago when I first started here that there was a regular lull in North Carolina politics. Oftentimes it would happen in these odd-numbered years, heading into the even years. Mm-hmm. You'd have 4, 5, 6 months where it was relatively quiet. We haven't had a lull in North Carolina politics for at least 3 years. When will we get the next lull in North Carolina politics?
I don't think it'll be anytime soon. 2020 is going to be a huge year. Democrats and Republicans have both identified North Carolina as a key battleground state from the White House to the State House. 2022, of course, will be an election where we have new congressional districts. So you may have a lot of new faces running for Congress. There'll be new districts. So I would say that for those who like to, those in your business who like to cover politics, or those who just like to follow politics, they're going to have a lot to talk about for the next few years and the foreseeable future.
To that point, what's the most exhausting part of your job?
Really, probably the travel, because I'm not content with just sitting in Raleigh in the speaker's office. I really believe it's important to get out around the state to meet with my members, Democrats and Republicans, to go to their districts to let folks know that we work for them here in Raleigh. I've always said, I didn't coin this, but I believe it, that the House is the elected body that's closest to the people. You know, folks can get to us. They see it at the church, the grocery store, school, you name it. Whereas you really can't do that with the governor or some of these other offices. So I think it's important that we're out and we're being seen. So, but it is exhausting. It's a big state, but we're going to keep doing that.
True or false, you hate onions?
Oh, I hate onions. I'm allergic to them. So yeah,
are you really allergic?
Yeah, I'm really allergic to them. Absolutely. So yeah, so that doesn't mean those who don't like me don't need to send me onions just because it's not good. But I don't like onions.
North Carolina House Speaker Tim Moore, in his ninth term from Cleveland County, first elected to the North Carolina General Assembly back in 2002. Speaker, thank you for coming back on the podcast.
Good to be with you as well. I'm glad you didn't have any onions either.
They're in the cupboard over there.
All right.
As always, you can subscribe to the program at iTunes, Google Play, or Stitcher. Stay up to date with whatever is happening or is not happening with budget debates, Medicaid conversations, and more in the North Carolina political sphere at our website, wunc.org. For Tim Moore, I'm Jeff DeBeery. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you again soon.